It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
It was a clean sweep. Ainsley, Brian, and Steve, good morning. It was a hat trick, if you will, Brian. And it's the clearest indication, perhaps, that voters are not looking for radical change in these frightening times. Biden now has an undeniable commanding lead in the race. Look at this. 1,147 delegates to Sanders' 861. Now, Biden held no victory rally last night, just a live stream from his Delaware home, appealing to Bernie's base.
So let me say, especially to the young voters who have been inspired by Senator Sanders, I hear you. I know what's at stake.
Here's how big of a night Biden had in Arizona, winning by more than 12%, in Illinois by 23%, and in Florida, the state with the biggest delegate prize, dominating by nearly 40%. Sanders was absent the airways after the polls closed, but earlier in the night, laying out his vision of how to rescue the nation.
What we must do is empower Medicare to cover all medical bills during this emergency, if you're uninsured, if you are underinsured, if you have high deductibles, if you have high copayments, if you have out-of-pocket expenses, Medicare will cover those expenses.
And those images, guys, you mentioned, just surreal, with voters and volunteers both in masks and gloves. But the question is, what happens next, right? More states are postponing their elections out of coronavirus concerns. Maryland was the latest yesterday to join Louisiana, Georgia, and Kentucky to postpone. The DNC is very worried about changes against their primary calendar. Remember, their convention is second week of July. The chairman, Tom Perez, is hoping states will make it easier and safer and definitely start using those mail ballots to get it done. The next slew of primaries comes first week of April, and that will coincide with the end of this 15-day period when we may have some clarity on just how bad things are, but it is certainly not certain what will happen to the Democrat primary race right now.
All right. Of course, that was Griff Jenkins, Sandy Rios with you this morning. Now, I just want to say before I start talking to you this morning that the election yesterday and the election cycle that we're in right now is going to be, again, it really is still extremely important. And while we're all caught up talking about coronavirus, we will have to live with the results of this election this year. And actually, as a matter of fact, I'm going to be talking with Hans von Spakovsky today about the effect of coronavirus on the elections. So stay tuned for that. But just remember that this is important. So I'm going to start talking about it first today because I think it's, I want to keep it the focus for you on what this means, who takes over, whether it's the congressional seats or the Senate seats or the presidency after the coronavirus is passed, and it will pass. It will pass by the end of summer, and I kind of think maybe even sooner. I have no inside information on that. I'm just saying I don't know how this could go on. I know how it could, but based on all that's happening, I don't see how they could continue it. What I mean is, with everybody shutting down and staying home, I don't think we're going to have a big, huge outbreak. And so I think it's going to be over sooner rather than later, but I don't have any knowledge of that. It's just my hunch. All right, so back to the election. You heard Griff say that Joe Biden won handily in Arizona by 12 percentage points, in Illinois by 23 percentage points, and in Florida by 40 percentage points. I want to just give you an analysis. I thought this was excellent. It's a Fox News voter analysis. And I want to kind of walk you through what they found when they surveyed people that had voted in these states. Democratic primary voters have said that health care is the top issue facing the country. They said that in all three states. Ohio did not hold their vote yesterday, as you probably know. Nearly half of them cited health care as the top issue in Arizona and Florida. And last week in Missouri, 47% of Democratic primary voters said that health care was their top priority. And then Despite the recent reversal in the stock market, fewer than 2 in 10 voters in each state called the economy the top issue. And they placed it just ahead of climate change in Florida and Illinois, and in third place in Arizona. I find that interesting. Makes me wonder if people are not connecting the dots between the economic downturn as a result of coronavirus and their own personal circumstances. I sometimes think that it isn't just the stock market, but of course, for those of you that are retired and you have, you had retirement savings, everything is tied to the stock market. Unless you've saved cash in your life and that's what you're living on, everybody is tied up with what happens to the market. So I just don't know if that dot is not being connected, if people don't have savings, if they're just living on Social Security and they think that's immune. Social Security is not immune to the economic welfare of this country. In fact, I heard an estimate, it's been a year and a half, maybe something like that ago, so I can't remember the exact date, but let's just say that Social Security is supposed to be bankrupt in something like, I want to say, less than 20 years, maybe even less than that. The continual spending of the federal government is going to impact each one of us. There's a point at which the whole ship will go down because there will not be money to fund your pensions, your Social Security, all the things. You know, most of us have money coming in from the government in one form or fashion. And again, unless you have prepared for your later years in complete cash and in the bank, and even in banks, you know, there's really nothing in this world you can totally count on. But cash would be the only thing that would be safe at this point. And I think precious few people save their money just in cash these days. So I just don't think people get the importance of what's just been happening to the markets. 7 in 10 voters in each state favored changing to single-payer health care. Boy, that's a lack of understanding too, isn't it? We're seeing the results of the care of single-payer health care in Italy in the wake of the coronavirus there. We are seeing it in Europe where it's like the front lines of the breakout right now where doctors just can't keep up. And actually, if I have time today, I want to read you a piece written by an Italian doctor. First-hand report of what's going on there. It's pretty fascinating. Socialized medicine is not working in those countries, by the way. Democratic primary voters remain split between preferring a candidate who would restore the political system the way it worked before Trump and a candidate who promises fundamental change. Biden won 6 in 10 restore voters in Arizona and roughly 8 in 10 in Florida and Illinois. And there's more to say about that. I want to get down to in Florida, seniors made up more than a third of the electorate. Biden won handily. Sanders' trouble in Florida might have been related to his bragging of Fidel Castro and his Cuba regime, and that didn't play well among Hispanic voters for Sanders of all stripes, including Puerto Ricans, which I thought was very interesting. But despite being Jewish himself, Sanders was unable to earn significant support from Florida's sizable Jewish population. Sanders in Arizona, which was his best state, he won the Latino vote only by an 8-point margin, but he didn't win an outright majority among them. Illinois, religious voters of every major denomination went for Biden. He won the Jewish vote by a 41-point margin. Non-religious voters split pretty much evenly. There's a lot more to this, but I just thought that's a really interesting article, and it kind of gives a good rundown and analysis of Democratic voters in the states that voted yesterday. I want to talk about Illinois for a second because interesting things. This is from Illinois Newsroom, and it said there was actually a good turnout in voting yesterday. It was down significantly from the presidential primary of 2016, but still good. Again, Joe Biden won by 23 percentage points. I have talked to you about a couple of candidates in Illinois who are strong conservatives who the Freedom Caucus, their Freedom Fund, has endorsed. And one of them was Jeannie Ives, who just won last night. That was Peter Roskam's old seat, and it was taken away from Peter in 2018 when the Democrats took over the House. So Jeannie Ives will now face off with that freshman, Sean Casten. And that'll be an interesting race because that's my old district. That's where I used to live. It's Wheaton and Glen Ellen and those areas. Also in downstate, Mary Miller did win the seat to take John Shimkus' seat. Mary is, I think, much more conservative than John Shimkus. So now she has to face, of course, the Democratic opponent. And so we'll see what happens with that. But That's what happened in Illinois. Also in Illinois, now this is sad to me, Dan Lipinski, I know Dan, he's a Democratic congressman from the Chicago area. He's pro-life, and he voted against Obamacare. He's been like the lone man in the Democratic Party for a long time, a lot of nerve. His dad held the seat that he took over several years ago, actually, for many, many years. But he was defeated yesterday by Marie Newman, who was endorsed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And, of course, she embraces all that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez embraces. And so Dan Lipinski has gone down. He was, I think, the only, at least for a long time, he was the only Democrat who was pro-life. There may be some others now that I don't know about, but that's what happened in Illinois. Now, in terms of the coronavirus, I think the big news, of course, is the proposed bailout, which is almost $1 trillion. And maybe John Roberts would do better telling you about it than I. Let's listen.
The federal response to the coronavirus is beginning to look a lot like the fiscal stimulus of 2008-2009. The difference back then, the economy was in danger of collapse and needed the stimulus. This time around, the fundamentals of the economy are still very strong, but the federal government is being forced to literally shut parts of it down.
Please distance.
On Capitol Hill today, the Treasury Secretary and other White House officials hoping to convince Republicans to pony up hundreds of billions of dollars to keep businesses and taxpayers afloat.
Hardworking Americans are impacted by government decisions. That's when the government has to step up to put money into the economy.
A major part of the proposal, putting cash in the hands of American workers, literally cutting them a check from the federal government.
We don't want people losing their jobs or not having money to live when they were doing very well just 4 weeks ago. So we're going big, and that's the way it'll be.
Another part of the plan, help for the airlines, a bill that could eventually approach $60 billion. And now the hotel industry, business collapsing. The CEO of Hilton Hotels today telling the president it's bad.
I've been doing this for 35 years, never seen anything like it.
One other measure the White House announced today, with tax day rapidly approaching, a 90-day deferral in taxes owed for individuals or people who have small businesses who file as individuals. They can defer up to $1 million in taxes. Corporations will be able to defer up to $10 million. Again, Brett, that's for 90 days.
All right, and there's a lot more to that story, actually. It's kind of frightening to me. I said this to you yesterday. It's the answer to everything seems to be to pay Americans, look, all right, I'll finish my sentence, to make as much money available as possible, to throw money at everything. That's what Barack Obama did after the crash of 2009. I would say that some people said the problem with that stimulus package of that happened under Barack Obama is that it went to the wrong people. It gave money to people that don't even pay taxes, and it did not solve the problem. So it was basically wasted money. And so if we are going to give money, it needs to be given very smartly. George Rasley from Conservative HQ has a great piece on this. Basically, it's titled, Take Care of the Little Guys First. Now, I'm not a big business opponent, but George makes some really, and he isn't either. I want to make some points that George makes here. The White House, of course, is pushing a third coronavirus stimulus package with a price tag of about $850 billion. Largely in the form of tax relief measures. This third coronavirus spending package worth hundreds of billions is being circulated even before the Senate has finished work on a more modest second relief bill that focuses on leave for workers and expedited testing for COVID-19. And George goes on to make the case that it's small business in the country here that are the economic, that are the engine of economic growth here, and that they're the ones that need, if anyone needs help, they can't sustain these losses like corporations can. Not really. Not either or, but just make sure if you're going to give money, you may give it where it counts. Small businesses are the ones who hire all these hourly workers that you see who are suffering because they're waiting tables or doing whatever they're doing. And so we'll put this article of George's on our Facebook page. Take care of the little guys first. Sandy Rios in the morning. What's the COVID virus going to do to 2020 election? Stay tuned.
The AFA, Marriage, Family, and Life Conference is coming June 25th through the 27th. Experts have lined up to help Christians make a difference in our increasingly wicked culture.
Dr. Alex McFarland.
There was a day when America was thoroughly predisposed to Christianity.
Dr. Michael Brown.
The pro-life consciousness in America is much more of a political and social and cultural and spiritual battle here in America than in other countries.
Bishop E.W. Jackson.
We get so used to seeing this perversion that it becomes normal.
Will and Miki Addison.
There is a first line defense against sex trafficking, and that would be intact families. That would be fathers being present, showing their daughters healthy affection, defending and protecting them.
The Marriage, Family, and Life Conference at Hope Church in Tupelo, June 25th through the 27th, includes a children's track as well. Learn more and register at marriagefamilylife.net.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Charles Rettig, Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Mr. Rettig oversees administration and management of revenue and tax-related laws in the United States, while also serving as an advisor to the President. Proverbs 19:20 reminds us of the importance of wise counsel. Listen to advice and accept discipline, and at the end, you will be counted among the wise. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask for guidance for Charles Rettig as he advises the President. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
What do you see for the next generation? Do you see a prospering nation? Do you see hope? The future is ours to create, and Liberty University is driven to train positive influencers for our country and our culture. Our mission is to guide students toward leadership as servants of the people, defenders of freedom, and champions of truth. Discover how you can impact the next generation of champions for Christ by texting GIVE to 839-858.
It's going to take more than a global pandemic to stop Bob Shellard from being with the love of his life. Mr. Shellard and his wife Nancy celebrated their 67th wedding anniversary the other day, but it was a bit of an unusual celebration. You see, Nancy is in a nursing home in Connecticut. Bob used to visit his wife every day without fail, but not these days. No visitors allowed on account of the coronavirus. So Bob had to come up with a plan B. He bought a bevy of balloons and he wrote a message on a large poster board. I've loved you 67 years and still do. Happy anniversary. That's what Bob wrote. Nancy beamed and blew kisses from the safety of her perch. You can see pictures at toddstearns.com. A beautiful reminder that love, true love, can transcend time and turmoil and even pandemics. Bob and Nancy, happy anniversary. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I did not for a moment think there was anything problematic because I knew the dynamics. Again, I have to stay healthy so I can make the decisions for the people of the city.
That was the mayor of New York when he got caught going to the gym as usual, when he was asking the rest of New York to stay home and not do anything, go to restaurants, not go to the gym. But Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, had a different set of rules, which is what the left always does. That doesn't apply to them. And it makes me wonder what's going to happen with him when he comes up for election. You think that's going to make people angry? Something like that? Well, it might. And that brings us to our discussion today about what the coronavirus might do to the upcoming elections, how they might affect. And I can't think of anyone who's probably thought this through better than my next guest, because Hans von Spakovsky talks about elections all the time. He is the senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the co-author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Also, Hans was part of the Federal Election Commission from 2006 and 2007, and a former counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Justice Department. Hans, good morning, and thanks for joining me.
Sandy, good morning to you, and thanks for having me back.
Hans, it would be interesting just for a second to talk to you about just a general thing about how do you think we had an election yesterday, and like in Illinois, the turnout was lower than 2016, but it was actually pretty good. So just how this virus, the coronavirus, is going to affect this 2020 cycle in general. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think once folks realize in the upcoming primaries that they can easily vote by absentee ballot if they don't want to actually show up at the polling place, maybe turnout will be a little bit less, but I don't think it's going to be significantly affected by the coronavirus. And the same thing in November in the general election. As you know, it's scheduled for November 3rd. And again, I suspect that concerns about the virus may have died down considerably by then. Everybody seems to believe it will have peaked long before then. And so I just doubt it's going to be a big factor. Again, particularly because in every single state and the District of Columbia, you can vote through an absentee ballot. And, of course, if you are staying isolated in your home, you can vote an absentee ballot without ever leaving it because, of course, it's mailed to you. You fill it out in your home. You stick it back in the mail. The postman picks it up. So you can vote without ever leaving your house.
But Hans, haven't we discovered that there's a ton of fraud in absentee voting? That's I guess the other effect. I mean, yes, people can vote, but maybe people might vote that aren't allowed to vote, or they might vote more than once. I mean, we have seen fraud in that, right?
Yes, I mean we should be concerned about the fact that absentee ballot fraud occurs, unfortunately, quite a bit. Florida, for example, has had case after case after case of that, and that's something we've got to be cognizant of and careful about. But you can't get rid of the absentee ballot process because there are many people who legitimately, because of illness and other reasons, can't actually get to the polls. So we've got to be careful with it. But if this pandemic is still a problem in November, then that probably be the way many people vote.
Now, I heard a really bad joke a couple of days ago, and I'm going to tell it badly, but you'll get the point. But the joke was something like, if President Trump cancels the presidential election in 2020 because of this virus, we will immediately have a cure for coronavirus. So that's a bad joke. But so people are talking about, they speculated about President Trump having some control over this November election, and he wants to be president for life, and he's, on the verge of doing something about making that happen. So, Hans, you wrote a whole article about this called Can Trump Use Coronavirus to Delay the 2020 Election? Can he?
No, the answer to that is no. And that's just people who don't like the president fantasizing. The president and the executive branch of the federal government have absolutely no authority of any kind under the Constitution or federal law to in any way suspend or delay the November 3rd election. The only entity that can do that is Congress. Under the Constitution, Congress is given the authority to set the date for both congressional elections and the presidential election, and by federal law, as you know, Sandy, they've designated the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November for that. So Congress could change the date, but to do that, a bill would have to be passed by the U.S. House, it would have to get passed by the U.S. Senate, and it would have to be signed into law by the president. Now, what do you think the likelihood is of that happening? I don't think there's much likelihood of that at all.
I don't. I do not think that's going to happen with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, right now. But
right.
The other thing, though, Hans, that's been really brought home clearly is that the states have autonomy over their elections. I think this is the one area where we really see this in living color, like the governor of Ohio decided not to have their primary yesterday. Talk about how that is handled in our Constitution.
Sure. The federal government has no power over state elections, and primaries are state elections, including the presidential primary. So in each state, it depends on what the law is. In every state, of course, the state legislature has the ability to set the date of their primary elections. In some states, and Florida actually is another good example of that. In some states, the state legislature has given the governor the power to change the date of an election in cases of emergency. If they declare an emergency, they can do that. Not all states allow that. Ohio actually is one of them that doesn't allow it. And what happened was a state court actually told the governor he couldn't do that. So he then turned to apparently the head of the state health department, who used laws regarding health emergencies to put off the date of the election. But as you know, three states yesterday, as you said, went through with it, and even though turnout was a little bit lower, people still turned out to vote.
What do you think about, this is speculation, I understand, but why do you suppose the governor of Ohio felt so compelled to do that when the other three states went on business as usual? I heard his statements. I mean, he talked about older poll workers, and he was trying to protect them, but that would be the case in every state. What are your thoughts about what would be the motive with Ohio not going through with a vote that maybe we don't know about?
I'm really not sure. I think he just didn't. I think he made a judgment call. Given what happened in the other states, it looks to me like his judgment call was not the correct one. But, you know, why he did it? Was he really concerned about the spread of the virus? Look, that very well may be. It may have had nothing to do with any kind of political calculations whatsoever. And by the way, just kind of an interesting fact of history when it comes to these kind of issues and politics, a lot of people don't, I think, remember that when New York was attacked on 9/11, it was actually the day of the statewide primary in New York. Huh. And there was a little known, political unknown, guy running on that day to be mayor of New York named Michael Bloomberg.
Oh,
and
boy.
The polls actually opened at 6 a.m. that day, but were closed after the attacks by the governor, and the election was rescheduled for 2 weeks later. So some folks have actually said that delay helped Michael Bloomberg in the primary and helped him get elected mayor.
Well, that kind of goes into my next question, because just help us think through, what are the repercussions of changing the date of a primary? I mean, how does that in general affect, is it just that people would not know? You'd have less people come because maybe some of them follow the pattern, or that candidates have advertised a certain date? What do you think the repercussions of that might be?
Well, if you are somebody who's a relative unknown, but you've got the money to fund a campaign, a two-week delay, a three-week delay may give you more time to try to reach voters and convince them that they should vote for you instead of one of the other candidates in the race. So the potential is there that, you know, it might help somebody who perhaps doesn't have as good a name recognition as other candidates, or the voters don't know, it might help them win an election. But, look, every situation is going to be different. You're not going to know how it's going to affect things until you're actually there and in it.
I guess there's probably some comfort in the fact that states kind of control their own systems.
Yes.
I've heard this. I probably heard you say that before, and I'm beginning to understand more and more why we don't need. I remember when Jay Johnson, remember he started talking about nationalizing elections?
No, that's
anyway,
right. And
yeah.
that's a big danger. We don't want a federal government being able to control elections in this country.
Yeah, so for all the confusion is probably a gift to all of us, because it helps the states have more control over what their own people do. Now, from your vantage point, we briefly said, Hans, that you were part of the Federal Election Commission. That was an appointment by President Trump right after his election. It was a great commission. J. Christian Adams was on it and others. And you guys were going to be trying to clean up the voting, just to look for voter fraud and try to make things right and clean up the voting rolls. And you will remember better than I how you were shut down and how the left came after you guys with a vengeance. And so you weren't able, and the states did not cooperate. So
that's right.
That being the case, where are we now with making sure our elections are what they should be with integrity?
Well, in a lot of places, we're in very poor shape. And things have actually gotten worse in the past 2 years because states have done things, states like California and Illinois, to make things worse. Both those states, for example, have put in automatic voter registration, which automatically registers to vote anyone going in for a driver's license or, like in California, applying for public assistance. And that's already been found to cause all kinds of problems. Illinois, a month or two ago, had to admit that it had, through this system, mistakenly registered to vote hundreds of aliens, people who were not U.S. citizens, and then 2 weeks later, they had to admit that they had registered thousands of 16 and 17-year-olds who had gone in for the driver's license. They had registered them to vote.
Wow.
So the voter rolls are in terrible shape all over the country, including tens of thousands of people who are illegally registered in more than one state. So and a lot of states like California and Illinois don't seem to have much interest in doing anything to clean this up.
Well, because they have control of their legislatures and their governments and the governances, and they don't want that to change. Really, they are. You just have no chance if you're a conservative in California or Illinois, although there were a couple of conservatives that won in the primaries yesterday in Illinois, which is pretty encouraging. But, all right, so Hans, in regard to the 2020 election, is there any other way that you can see that this coronavirus could affect the primaries and the upcoming election?
Well, the only real effect would be really lowering turnout expectations. And as you know, that when you have low turnout, a small number of people, a small dedicated group can often make quite a difference in the election, a difference they might not be able to make in a high turnout election. Who would benefit in a low turnout election, the president or Joe Biden? That I don't know. But that's the one thing that might change what today people think might be the outcome of the election.
Yeah, I was actually thinking through that, and I thought, well, okay, so there's the older voters. You know, will they be more or less likely to come out in November if there's coronavirus? I agree with you. God willing, it'll be yesterday's headline. Well, we will have forgotten coronavirus by November because we forget quickly. And young people, you know, will they turn out? And Trump haters, are they going to be motivated or more than Trump supporters? I guess there's just no way to know.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's any way to know that particular fact.
All right, so how much detail? You go into your article a great amount of detail, really, about the Constitution laying the groundwork for elections. And you gave a specific day for the presidential election, but they also control the Electoral College. Talk about that for a second.
Sure. I think most people understand, although some Americans don't, that when you go in and vote on November 3rd, you're actually voting for a slate of electors. These are people who have pledged to vote for a particular candidate. And what happens is in December, the electors for each state who have won, and that'll be either the electors who's pledged they would vote for Joe Biden or the electors who pledged they would vote for Donald Trump, they actually meet at your state capitol and cast their votes for president. And it's those electoral votes that are then sent to Congress and are the determination of who actually is elected president. And as you know, in only a couple of times in our history has the vote of the Electoral College not matched the national popular vote. And I don't see the coronavirus in any way preventing the electors from meeting in December and casting their official votes for president.
Hans, thank you always for your expertise. We're going to put Hans's article, Can Trump Use Coronavirus to Delay the 2020 Election? Put it on our Facebook page and you can share it with your friends and people that you know that are on your that are friends of yours on Facebook. Hans, thank you for joining me this morning. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Sandy Rios in the morning, back right after this.
You shall not bear false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Numerous reports circulated that Ilhan Omar had engaged in an affair with her fundraising chief, Tim Minette. Ilhan Omar denied it. Minette's wife divorced him due to his affair with Omar, yet Omar still denied it. Now, Ilhan Omar posted on her own Instagram page that she and Tim Minette are married. From denials to admission. There were also numerous reports that Ilhan Omar formally married her biological brother in an immigration fraud scheme. But Omar has denied them too. Will those denials turn the way of her recent nuptials?
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
To sharpen the biblical worldview of Christians and to share the good news of Jesus Christ, that is the mission of the Christian Worldview Radio program. I'm host David Wheaton, inviting you to join us this Saturday morning at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, as we discuss all matters of life and faith from a decidedly biblical perspective. The Christian Worldview, Saturday mornings at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, right here on American Family Radio.
Dad, come play with me. Snow's perfect for a snowman.
Sorry, sport. Maybe tomorrow. It's almost your bedtime.
Many young parents struggling to do the best for their children have asked themselves, are we good parents? The answer is no. You cannot be a good parent because you are essentially not good. However, our Father, the only good parent, can and will work through us in the lives of our children if we will just ask Him.
Read more at EngageMagazine.net.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. God has given us a charge to take this land for Christ, just as He instructed Joshua to take the land of Canaan for God. Our battle is not a physical one as theirs was, but rather a spiritual one. But it is a war nonetheless. It may seem at times as if we are opposed, as Joshua was, by a great horde of troops in number like the sand on the seashore. It may even be God's will to harden the hearts of our cultural and spiritual adversaries against us, but this is only to provide a greater display of God's power. We are told that after making war with his enemies for a long time, Joshua took them all in battle. How do we take this land for Christ today? It begins with obedience. Joshua, we're told, left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded him, and God gave him the victory. May He do the same for us today.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Democratic operatives have insisted for much of Donald Trump's presidency that, quote, no one is above the law, unquote. It's one of their more cynically hypocritical lines of attack against him, since they clearly don't mean that the rule of law should apply to their partisans, too. Take, for instance, Hillary Clinton and her long-running and thus far successful efforts to ensure that she and her entourage are not held to the same standards and statutes that apply to everybody else. To that end, the former Secretary of State is frantically trying to overturn a federal judge's order that she must be deposed by Judicial Watch about her illegal email server and its serial compromises of national security secrets. The question occurs, why on earth are the Trump administration's Justice and State Departments helping Hillary get preferential instead of equal treatment under the law? This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
China and others have criticized you for using the phrase Chinese virus. How do you feel about that? Are you going to continue using that phrase?
Well, China was putting out information which was false, that our military gave this to them. That was false. And rather than having an argument, I said, I have to call it where it came from. It did come from China. So I think it's a very accurate term. But no, I didn't appreciate the fact that China was saying that our military gave it to them. Our military did not give it to anybody.
Critics say using that phrase creates a stigma.
No, I don't think so. No, I think saying that our military gave it to them creates a stigma.
That's really interesting because China, of course, has been a trading partner. We have been told how friendly they are. A lot of you have some of your businesses and you've sent your work over to China. We all buy Chinese goods. Some of us have traveled to China frequently. We sort of had this impression that China has been our friend, and we've been told that as long as we are connected with them financially, nothing to worry about, that they will not threaten us. But that's just not true. And you heard that China now is trying to blame the United States for the coronavirus, and we know it came from China. And then when President Trump tries to say it's the Wuhan virus, it's the Chinese virus, the left accuses him of xenophobia. They take the side of the Chinese communists. It's pretty amazing. And as a matter of fact, yesterday, China expelled all foreign journalists working for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Let me just say that Hu Xiongying, a prominent government spokesperson for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said these were necessary countermeasures to fight back against the Trump administration's Cold War mentality. He said that the decisions are entirely necessary countermeasures that China has been forced to take because of the unreasonable oppression that Chinese media organizations experience in the U.S. They are legitimate, justified, self-defense in every sense. So China, of course, has completely cracked down, with the help of Facebook, Facebook's cooperation, and Google, too, on the ability of their people to honestly share things. It's complete control. There is no freedom of speech, and that's why the Chinese are really fighting right now. This is kind of a theme through what they're doing is give us free speech, give us free speech. And as a matter of fact, yesterday, you think it's not touching us? I'll tell you how this is going to affect us. We are not in a safe place when it comes to Facebook or Google. Not at all. And you've heard me say that before. Yesterday, Senator Cotton tweeted about China and the Wuhan virus and the origins of it. And people posted that on Facebook, and it was removed because it said it violated community standards. Senator Cotton's article about the virus originating in the Wuhan area of China was removed from Facebook by two people that I know of that posted it yesterday, and that said they said that it violated community standards. That's what happens when freedom of speech is lost, and that's what China is doing to their own people, and that's what they want to do to the world. So does the European Union. And so, by the way, we're going to be talking a great deal about China on Friday with Gordon Chang, about what's happened there, about the death of that doctor, I think you'll find it fascinating, so make sure that you tune in. On the brighter side, something funny. You know, have you seen those posters that have a picture of a gun, and the gun basically... The poster basically says, come and take it. All right. Well, somebody has been creative. And so they've got the same poster and they've got come and take it. But instead of a gun, it's a roll of toilet paper. So I just thought I'd share that with you. That's the new symbol of American defiance. Come and take my toilet paper. Just come and try to take it. I'll wait. So anyway, so the virus, the front lines of the virus now has really turned to Europe. And Brian Yenis had a report on that last night, and I wanted you to hear it. Let's listen.
It's now clear that the peak of the epidemic is coming fast in some parts of the country.
As Prime Minister Boris Johnson warns of an imminent surge of coronavirus cases in the United Kingdom, the United States is banning all travel from the UK and Ireland beginning midnight tonight. The disruption affecting an estimated 47,000 passengers that travel between the UK and US every day. The move expands US coronavirus travel restrictions already in place, banning all non-US citizens from China, Iran, and 26 other European nations. This comes as public health officials acknowledge most new COVID-19 cases in the U.S. have originated from Europe, which, according to the World Health Organization, has now become the epicenter of the pandemic.
We have seen a rapid escalation of cases of COVID-19.
Today, the European Union announced it will enact a minimum 30-day travel ban on all non-essential travel into the EU.
The less travel, the more we can contain the virus.
American passengers are being allowed back into the U.S. through 13 designated airports operating enhanced entry screenings. Passengers fill out a medical history questionnaire. Some get their temperatures taken. All must self-quarantine for 14 days.
All right, so that's an update on what's happening in Europe. Now, just to bring you up to date on what's happening today, all 50 states now are recording cases. Of course, there aren't many. There still aren't many. I just have to say, 114 deaths out of 300 million is still not very much. It's 114 too many, but most of them are elderly. Most of them are in Washington State and New York City, and I still find it interesting that they're not telling us who's dying. I mean, they tell us that it's the elderly, but where are the numbers? That doctor in China who died, we were told, of the virus that's caused such an uproar in China. He died, what, in February? Some are saying that he was too young to die of that virus, that they believe the Chinese government may have taken care of him. I don't know. That's what the Chinese people are suspecting. So why would a healthy doctor at 35 die of the virus if it's mostly the elderly that die of it? I don't know. There are a lot of questions about that still for me, a lot of questions. But 114 deaths so far, and most of the increases, if not all, have come in New York City. There are 6,400 cases of this virus nationwide, and so that's kind of the update today. Now, there have been a lot of discussions about healthcare workers. I think you've probably seen pictures in Italy where people are lined up in the hallways and healthcare workers are exhausted. The same thing is happening in Great Britain. And could I, again, hasten to tell you that this is socialized medicine in action, or maybe we should say inaction. This is where care has to be rationed. There aren't as many doctors for that many people. They just don't have the resources. And with all the best intentions to give everyone medical care and make sure they're all taken care of, it's not possible. It's not possible financially to do that. And so this is what happens when the government controls medicine. And then they have to make hard choices. That means that they don't give the elderly much care because, after all, they are elderly. And they say they're treatment for younger people. Well, this is Piers Morgan talking about what's happening in Great Britain. From his perspective, this is clip six.
My biggest concern, you know, Gail on Facebook has contacted us. I'm a nurse who's working within a very busy, very stretched A&E department in the NHS. I feel like not one person cares about us. We're still turning up to work, putting ourselves and our families at risk. Our managers told us yesterday we are running out of masks, equipment to protect ourselves. We are still expected to look after people with or without PPE. Who cares about us and our families? No one. How awful that our healthcare workers are feeling so undervalued that they think nobody cares about them. Think about what these people are about to be going through. They are going into a system which is creaking at the seams already, we know that, that will come under the most intensive pressure it's ever had. Every nurse, doctor, consultant, surgeon, everyone involved, every porter in a hospital, every cleaner in a hospital, they are doing this, they're risking their lives, their health, their families' lives, their family's health, for us. So if you know anyone who works in the healthcare system, make them feel valued. Get behind them today. They need our support. They are going to be facing what Emmanuel Macron, President of France, has called a war. This is a war we're in now. And we have to support and defend people who are going to be in the front line of that war on our behalf.
All right, there was Piers Morgan. He's talking about the British healthcare system, National Health Service. I want to read to you something that someone sent me yesterday that was from a doctor in Italy. It's just, I just want to read it to you. He says, last night I received a phone call from my medical director with a request for help from a hospital in Lombardy located in a particularly critical area. I immediately gave my availability as 8 o'clock on Saturday. On Friday evening, after a short phone call with a colleague, I understood what to expect the next day. The majority of hospital doctors were at home in quarantine or had even tested positive for COVID-19 and therefore had been isolated. Whole wards had been dismantled and the intensive care units on the verge of collapse. From the moment I arrived in the parking lot, I understood the situation. Absolutely deserted, few cars and nobody around. At the entrance, an employee was handing out hand sanitizer and masks to the few people passing by. I arrived on the fifth floor, a medical ward that has been renamed COVID-19, with 40 hospitalized patients of different ages and genders who had either tested positive for the virus or were waiting to be tested. I met two colleagues with whom I then spent the whole day. We helped each other to dress properly, airtight overalls, double mask, glasses, gloves, etc., and started making rounds, taking arterial samples from all the patients, drawing up therapies, checking CT scans, and so on. Some cases were very serious, others less so, but all scans showed more or less severe cases of intestinal pneumonia. I saw fear and anxiety in every face, and the question often posed was, "Doctor, am I dying?" I was struck by the attitude of my colleagues, no complaining, no anguish, no fear, but an uncommon professionalism and humanity. For example, when communicating positive test results, they said, "Do not worry, you are positive, but we are here and we will do everything we can to cure you." I was fascinated and inspired by this positive position, and I immediately found myself reassuring and supporting those fragile patients. From 8 to 4:30, without stopping, 40 patients were cared for and treated by the three of us, who found ourselves in unimaginable harmony. After a 20-minute break, we were back immediately to recheck the hemograms and to calculate the risk and need of transferring the patients to the intensive care unit as further emergencies poured in. How can one remain so positive in the face of such devastation? A positive human position is only possible if you are human and professional with those you work with, and if you support each other, even in the midst of the drama of a day like this. This evening, I was recounting my day to my wife and children, and I was reminded of that passage in the gospel where Jesus is asleep in the boat and the disciples are afraid. They wake him up and he calms the waters by saying to them, "Why are you afraid? I'm with you. Don't be afraid." Today, I have experienced this in my work with my colleagues, and I thank them from the bottom of my heart. Our unity of purpose has made it easier for our patients to deal with the anguish and fear of this virus, so microscopic but so devastating. I think that increasingly we healthcare professionals have a responsibility to help these colleagues of ours who are in such difficulty. It has been a terrible day, but one that I have lived through intensely and that has deeply marked me and made me grow both humanly and professionally. I was sure that by saying yes to my director, I would have had the chance to live an experience I will never forget. And that's an Italian doctor telling his story. Now, this was sent to me by a Jewish friend, and I did not have any idea when I was reading it that he was going to be, that at the end he turned out to be a Christian. But I just think certainly God does not waste crisis, and certainly in Italy. Italy is probably the worst. Iran, too, we don't hear so much about them because of the nature of their regime, but Italy is probably suffering the most. And even though there are reasons for that I've given you, I think there are very strong reasons. I think they're open borders, they're in flux of people from all over the world, third world countries who don't have cleanliness standards, has cooperated, has contributed to this, plus their poor healthcare system, which is nationalized. Nevertheless, people are suffering there, and they are isolated, you know, in their apartments. I played for you, you know, a couple of days ago where they're, you know, playing their music, they're singing to each other. I saw one yesterday where two guys are playing ping pong. They're leaning out their apartment windows, which their apartments are adjacent, and they're playing ping pong with each other. And then when they finally, they're very good and it goes on for a long time. And then finally the ball, they drop the ball and somebody below has to, you can hear them shouting in the courtyard. They're finding ways, you know, to cope. And I think the lesson to be learned, of course, in this and any other situation is to look for ways to make the best, to be content. I don't mean content not to try to do something better, but to take your circumstances, take them all in and let God use them for his glory and your good. And I know that he will do that. Even if this thing is overblown, if people are exaggerating for some ulterior purpose, I think that God can bring good out of this. And so we're looking for that, and I think we're already seeing some of it. So hang on, fasten your seatbelts, and let's ride the waves, as my mother used to say. And I'll do that in the name of Jesus to try to bring honor to him, to talk to people that we don't normally talk to, and to use this to the glory of God. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.